There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounce signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Risonel, and I'm your host. On today's program, I don't know. But you want to stay tuned and find out why. I wasn't being entirely truthful there when I said I don't know. I obviously have some idea here, but the reason why I said that is Media Geek is a bit of a victim of technological malfunction for today's program. And rather than putting on a repeat or putting on something that I'd already played before, I thought I'd just come clean, but I got plenty of things and news to catch up on. Scheduled for today, as I mentioned on the last show, was to speak with Jill Friedberg, who has produced a really great film about what has happened in Oaxaca, Mexico, something which I've covered for the last year and a half here on Media Geek, especially with regard to the local people's movement, the APO, and their use of television and radio as part of the movement in defiance of the illegally elected and illegitimate governor of the state of Oaxaca in Mexico. The movie is called A Little Bit of Too Much Truth, Un Poquito de Tanta Verdad. And I did do the interview, but I don't have it. I use a recorder called a mini disc recorder, been used a lot by people in community radio and public radio and in media production. Going back to the mid-90s, to a time when things like MP3s did not exist, when cell phones didn't record audio, and pretty much if you recorded audio on your own, you used either a cassette recorder or you use a digital audio tape recorder. Digital audio tape recorders aren't being made anymore. And many of us are on the verge of disappearing, but they've been a pretty robust and nice medium that I've liked all along here, and it failed me. And it's worth sort of considering here because I thought I did everything right, and I've not been able to retrieve my poor recording, which happened not long after I did the interview, and unable to have the time, frankly, or the ability to redo the interview for today's program. And so I hope I'll be able to get Jill on in future so we can talk about this. It's a little bit of the pulling back the curtain to show that Media Geek is still the production of one guy. That's me. And I try to do it in the time that I have available to me. Some of it is, it's mostly spare time, which goes up and down. Lately, I've had more. It's because I've been free of some commitments that were sort of taking up more time. But there's still a limit to fitting it in with having a regular day job. Mine is as doing audio and video production, digital media production at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and trying to make it go. And here's one where all the best planning did not make it go for me, and I thought better to come forward and tell y'all it didn't work than to try and gloss it over. But I will try to get Jill on nevertheless in the near future, especially if she has the time. Because everyone who comes on as a guest does so simply because they wish to contribute to the program. They wish to get their message out. They want to be in the grassroots media, and I really appreciate their time and efforts. There is no scale paid here. This isn't a huge promotion platform, although there are enough listeners, I think, to make it worthwhile. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother doing it. Nevertheless, it's just another moment where I was forced to deal with the fact that I'm human and there's only so much that can go on here. And that goes on with blogging, that goes on with producing the show and everything else. It's really an up and down exercise. And it makes me sit back and think a little bit about how I can do a better job at it, or how maybe I shouldn't be doing a job at it. I don't know. I'm not thinking of giving up the show at this point. It also reminds me that as much as I trust a particular piece of technology, sometimes it my trust is not well placed. And I've been dealing with digital media and with other sorts of media forms, media tapes and whatever, for a long time, since I was a teenager. And I often pride myself on having lost very little data, lost very little voice, lost very little computer disks. I used a, been using a computer since the mid-80s, and I've always been extremely good about making copies of everything I have. I worked in computer labs at colleges at this university here and dealt with poor people who came up and had a disk with their whole assignment, their whole paper, sometimes a whole version of a dissertation. And, you know, and the disk was not working, and I've had to go, well, do you have a backup? And the answer was no. And I said, well, did you just lose the work that you did today? No, this was everything for the last 3 months, and realized, wow, you really can't trust this. So I've always been very good, and yet I was only recording to one recorder, which is a pretty common thing, especially if you're out there in the field. Carrying around two or three recorders is kind of difficult, and this one failed, and I don't have it there. So it is also me out there reminding you that whether you use computers, whether you're recording things, audio, video, you're doing multimedia of any kind, I implore you to make copies and to keep them, because none of this stuff is going to stick around a long time. A number of months ago, I had on Jimmy Jones, who works with Home Movie Day, here in Champaign-Urbana, but it's a worldwide phenomenon where they try to call attention to the value of old home movies, which people generally don't make anymore in terms of on actual 8 or 16 millimeter film. And there's these great memories, visions of the world as it once was, whether it's the families or other things that are sitting in closets and garages and attics and basements, often rotting away, and that they need to be preserved. And that preservation is an active process, but that it's not impossible, it's not foregone, and that we can't rely on this stuff to stick around on its own. You can have, the most, what you think is the most robust piece of media, but of course if you lose it, it's gone. And yet, even with CDs and DVDs, which when CDs came out in the early 80s, I remember people talked about them being nearly indestructible. Talked about CDs, never having to worry about, losing a good recording again, in the way that a record could get scratched or a cassette tape could get eaten by the machine. And it wasn't before long before people realized, no, that there was a limit to the amount of physical abuse that medium could withstand. In addition to the fact that after a while, we've now seen that some CDs do become unplayable because they're not perfect, because they rely on little tiny, tiny pits in aluminum inside of a polycarbonate shell. And if air gets in there, aluminum begins to oxidize and you lose the data. And that can happen with CDRs and DVDRs, happens with videotapes. And I work in an archiving situation at the university where we have videotapes that are maybe 20 years old in formats like U-matic or beta that are going away, where you can't buy recorders anymore. And so there's a need to keep them up to date. So protect your data, make a copy, and I've learned my lesson. The next interview I do, I'm actually going to daisy chain recorders. I'm going to have two recorders going on. This is a phone interview. I do it with a mixing board, and I have the ability to hook up more than one recorder, and I think I will. Sometimes we only learn our lessons when we get burned. And I did here, and I will be setting up a second recorder. And, I don't blame mini disc recorders, although some people might, because it could happen anywhere. Any machine could get unplugged, even the new great digital recorders that you can buy now, audio recorders that record to like flash media like you use in digital cameras or your camcorders. It can happen to anybody. And, of course, at some point we always have to take the risk and hope that something's going to work out, and we all risk that it be lost. But nevertheless, I'm gonna try and be sure And that's something here. I'm not just sort of killing time. I do have some news to talk about here. But I want to talk about it because, you know, part of my program is encouraging people to make media, encouraging people to think about grassroots media, to think about independent stuff as doable. And I think more and more doable because technology is kept up with us and provides opportunities, even if the opportunities are not ones that a lot of powers wish were not there. But to take advantage of them and to use them well requires a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of care. I don't know how many times that I've had to help poor faculty who've come through with something very important to their research and, you know, that got accidentally erased. And they want to know, can we go back and retrieve the information that was on there originally before they recorded over, like on CSI? And the problem is CSI is television, and certainly there are a few services that'll give you a good try for a few hundred to $1,000 a minute. But most of the time, no. So guard it well. If you're making media, it is valuable. And I think that's the other real thing here is if you bother to make it, it is valuable. You should hold on to it. You should try and keep it. You should try. You never know when it's going to become valuable later. Maybe for reasons you never thought of. In the early days of the Pacifica Foundation in the 50s and the 60s, they often reused tapes because magnetic tape, you know, reel-to-reel tape, audio tape, was very expensive. And so if you didn't think you're going to need it again, you would record over it. And who knows what audio and interviews from great civil rights activists, from radicals of that time, political radicals, great minds who were carrying on Pacifica because they really weren't welcome, and any other radio station or radio network have been lost because of that economy. We have to deal with what we have to deal with. We're lucky now, at least in the United States and Canada, to live in a time when digital media is cheap. CDRs are 20, you know, costs pennies. Digital videotape costs a few bucks. Cassette tapes are still there if you want to use them. I said, make your copy and, you know, do what you can. Hold on to your stuff. I have more copies of the Media Geek radio show than I can possibly deal with, not to mention what I put up online at radio.mediageek.net. And I'm glad I do, because if I decided to air a repeat, it's pretty easy for me to go find a show or go find an interview I've done in the past and bring it back on the air, because I've tried to really respect my own archives and keep them in good form. And what I also do is keep them in multiple forms. So a lot of them are on mini discs, because that's what I use to record them at the station or use to record them when I go out. But then I also make copies on the CD and other things like that. And if that's something people are interested in hearing more about, because I think it's possible for me to invite folks on who work in this area to talk more about this preservation and also how you might do this stuff at home with the equipment you already own. I'd be glad to do it. I don't always know whether or not people are interested in hearing this sort of more instructional material, whether they want to hear more political material. You know, a lot of it is just my guess, and I could be wrong. So drop me a line, paul@mediageek.net. If there is some of these things that I mentioned that you'd like to hear more about, of course, I'm going to continue doing the show here. And it is Media Geek. I'm Paul Riismandel. I'm the guy who somehow accidentally erased or lost the interview that was supposed to be on today's program. But otherwise, it's your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. It's online at the blog, MediaGeek.net, which I'm also having problems with. Somehow my theme, my graphic layout, my design keeps getting reset every day or every other day. So it's just this torrent. Plus, I'm getting spam links put on my site somehow as well. So the limits of my technological savvy are being tested this week, and I'm hoping to fix that up. I upgraded the software that runs the Media Geek website called WordPress, which is great, great open source, collaboratively created, free web blogging software. And I thought that was going to fix this problem, but it hasn't. And I'm sort of running out of options. It's wonderful when it works, as we all know. And it really sucks when it doesn't. Okay. And that was another example of technology not working. I'm not exactly sure what that was. Welcome aboard to the Media Geek radio program in stunning stereo here live on Community Radio WEFT, now on the web at weft.org. All right, well, let's get to talking about our media environment here. One of the big stories that's come through the tech world this week is the revelation, as discovered by the Associated Press, that Comcast, the largest cable company in the United States, and therefore the largest provider of cable modem service, has been filtering its customers' traffic, specifically with regard to a peer-to-peer networking application called BitTorrent. And according to research by the AP and backed up by a lot of other people on the net who've tried to replicate it, is that the traffic, which is part of BitTorrent's peer-to-peer network, is being captured by Comcast, and then they're spoofing, they're pretending that it's your computer, and then telling the peers that you're communicating with that you're unavailable, and therefore ending the BitTorrent traffic. Now, for those of you who may not be so aware what BitTorrent is and peer-to-peer, I mean, I think people have heard the term, but always understand how it works, and I haven't really covered much of it on Media Geek in a long time, is that BitTorrent is a very efficient way of allowing people to be able to download anything. So it can be application CDs, video, audio, text files, etc., by distributing the load. You see, internet bandwidth limits what any given server, any given computer can possibly put out and let someone download over the net. You do pay for that if you own a server or you run a server. And so if you can share the load, even for one particular file, and it's very popular, then for each person in that relationship, in the peering relationship, the network demand goes down. BitTorrent, of course, because it's simply an application, is used by people who are primarily interested in sharing copyrighted material that the copyright owners wish they wouldn't share, whether it's software, audio, or video. Because it makes it very easy to set up a peering relationship where it, you know, these various files lie on hundreds of thousands of computers, and only on the computers of people who actually went ahead and downloaded it themselves and made it available for sharing. So only people who opted in. But it can also be used in a lot of different ways to allow people to download things which people desire to be downloaded. And in fact, BitTorrent is actually used by a lot of open source software projects where the full installation may be hundreds of megabytes into gigabytes, which can be very expensive to host with a web host. And so they'll allow it to be put out by BitTorrent so that the people who are using the software are sort of sharing the load to make it accessible to everybody. Things that they want to see out there. It's being used more and more by bands who want to, and musicians who want to give away or make it very easy for people to download their audio or video. I believe the new Radiohead album is available as a BitTorrent download, and that's Radiohead is permitting that, so that they don't have to shoulder all the costs, and there is can be significant to allow people to download it from their own websites. There's a lot of very legitimate purposes to peer-to-peer, but Comcast apparently has chosen this one because it does tend to mean someone's bandwidth usage goes up if they're a BitTorrent peer, meaning if you've downloaded things through BitTorrent and then, you know, told the network, told the peering network that yes, and people can download that from me too, then it does increase the traffic load, the amount of internet traffic that someone does. And I guess Comcast is figuring because it's associated with piracy and illegal downloading that it's a pretty good target. And that seems to have been a bad calculation on the part of BitTorrent, since many people in the high-tech community, regardless of their political persuasion, realize that BitTorrent has turned out to be a very interesting technology, very useful technology for making bandwidth costs much more manageable. And the argument that Comcast should be able to filter out BitTorrent traffic from a particular customer of its cable service is getting harder to make, since the fact is the way that broadband service, internet broadband service, is supposed to be provided is that you pay a particular price to get a certain amount of service. Sort of like electricity in a way, or even like water, you pay for what you use. Now, generally in the United States right now, traffic internet is priced by the amount of service that's always on. So it's pretty much an on or off kind of thing. And so if you have a DSL line and they guarantee you get 1.5 megabits of service, the idea is that you're supposed to be able to use 1.5 megabits per service anytime, all the time. You turn it on, it's there. If it's not, it's not. And most internet connections remain very idle most of the time. Most internet connections, most people don't use nearly as much of the bandwidth that they do, and it's very rare that they peak it off. Bandwidth, broadband providers depend on that particular situation to be able to serve a lot of people and be able to predict to some extent how much bandwidth they need to give out. But then if they tell you you have 1.5 megabits of service, my opinion is you ought to get 1.5 megabits of service, even if that's 1.5 megabits of service all the time. And if they don't want customers to have that, then rather than selling a service which they say is 1.5 megabits, they ought to be much fairer about it and say up to speeds of up to 1.5 megabits with a cap of X number of megabytes or gigabytes or terabytes in a given amount of time. That's actually how I pay for my web service, which provides Media Geek and the Media Geek radio show. I pay a monthly fee. And there's a cap on how much the radio show can be downloaded. It's a pretty high cap. We don't come close to it. It's not nearly popular enough, although I suppose if I started putting up very popular top 40 songs, it would probably go like that. But with the Media Geek radio show, I don't have to worry about it. But when I hit that cap, they cut me off. So if all of a sudden, millions of people were downloading the Media Geek radio show, I'd hit my cap and I wouldn't be able to download anything more and no one else would be able to hit the site. And it seems to me that's a way that broadband can be priced. But what's really ticking off a lot of people, and especially what's ticking off legislators, is that not just that Comcast is filtering this BitTorrent traffic, but that they were being sneaky about it, that this wasn't being made clear. And on top of it, that the way that they were doing it may indeed be something that's opening them up to liability in a legal sense, because it wasn't a matter of... it was a matter of them actually spoofing, actually posing, having routers or other devices in their network, acting as if it's your machine with your own IP address, which is a kind of a scary thought, because if Comcast can do that for BitTorrent, it could do it for a lot of other things and could be used for bad reasons. You don't want someone spoofing it's your computer. I don't think Comcast is going to do this, but if someone was going to, could somehow let the Comcast network think that, their computer was your computer and they downloaded music they weren't supposed to download with your IP address or what was assigned to your house, to your computer, and then it's traced by the RIAA and you get sued, well, you're going to care that this spoofing technology is out there and that people are using it. Now, again, I don't think Comcast is going to do that. But it opens up a lot of very uncertain doors of identity here, which had not yet been opened. And it's causing people to get very upset about this fact. And it's, again, sort of reviving something which had been a little politically dormant, the notion of network neutrality. And that's coming up because of Verizon having been caught blocking pro-choice text messages, recent action by AT&T in a broadband broadcast where Pearl Jam's negative comments on George Bush were cut off. All these little actions start showing that a lot of the arguments that there can be a marketplace solution to this idea of a truly neutral internet, where you can pay for the kind of traffic you want and get that without otherwise being sneakily blocked, does not exist, and that there does need to be a legislative relief. And a big reason why it doesn't exist is, simply put, is that if you're a Comcast customer, you need to know that if you care about BitTorrent, if you care about peer-to-peer downloading, that they're actually blocking you. And two, you have to have an alternative to go to. And so in a lot of cities now, there are at least two alternatives, or one, there's usually cable and DSL. But if they were to both be blocking BitTorrent, you'd be out of luck. There would be no marketplace alternative. But furthermore, why this should be is also important is that if we get away from just simply BitTorrent, peer-to-peer is a very important technology. In fact, Skype, which is a very popular application used for audio conferencing on the web, mostly for free, uses a lot of peer-to-peer technology underneath. Peer-to-peer is a big, big movement in content distribution networks. And it's something you don't hear a lot about, but these are networks which are actually delivering much of the audio and video content that you're getting commercially on the internet, whether it's delivered by the NBC website or the Comedy Central website or other websites. Underneath that are usually very specialized content distribution networks with names like Limelight Networks or Real Networks does it, or there's Akamai, who are out there figuring out ways to move huge quantities of data quickly to people over the internet and invest a lot in infrastructure. And one of the biggest things being talked about right now is ways to use peer-to-peer, is a way to, you know, make that even easier by you know, with their permission, having the users, especially heavy users of audio and video content, allow some of their bandwidth to be used to be for someone else to download. It really allows a greater scale of distribution with people sharing the cost, in much in the way in which they're simply using resource they weren't otherwise already using. So it's sort of no additional cost to them because it was already available. And this is a huge business model, which people are looking at. So it goes beyond just even it goes into dollars, into ways which Wall Street cares about, beyond just the mere what I'm concerned about, the democratic implications of this selective filtering, which is all it is, of the type of information that comes in and out of your computer. Because just because it's peer-to-peer does not mean it is pirated, does not mean it's illegal. It very well may be something which someone wants you to have and you're being stopped from having it. I think it's fine for Comcast to charge more for people who are heavy users of bandwidth, and I think they ought to price plans that way. I'm a heavy user of bandwidth, and I'd like to be able to choose my plan, just like a cell phone service. Between, you know, you could pay for 300 minutes and 700 text messages or more or less if you're using it. I think they ought to price it that way too. And if I will, I'm going to want to be able to transfer, you know, 200 gigabytes of stuff in a month, and I'm willing to pay for it. And if I know I'm not, because I'm not going to watch audio or video, I'm not going to peer-to-peer or anything else, and I ought not to have to pay for it, rather than it being sneaky like this. And that may be require legislation, but it may, and what really, it may have to go towards net neutrality, because indeed what we're looking at is a reason is that this all happened a century ago with the telegraphs, with Western Union blocking certain messages, which brought out the idea of common carrier, where you have these very important utilities like the telephone, in which internet used to be considered common carrier, just 2 years ago by the FCC. And was protected. There was neutrality to make sure that all messages were treated equally. There could be no filtering and there could be no censorship. And since the FCC has ceased to consider internet service as common carrier, we are now starting to see these little tiny incursions into our ability to exchange messages and to send messages over the internet. And each one of them will be explained away, I'm certain, but they seem to be getting more profligate and they seem to be getting more comment as times move along each month into each month. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes and what kind of political steam this catches up. But I think that those who would dismiss this particular case and say, well, very few people actually use BitTorrent, I think it's to say, well, a lot of people may be using BitTorrent and not even know it, since the basic technology behind it, including the actual BitTorrent technology, is being integrated increasingly into all sorts of applications where people don't quite even understand that it's there, and yet they benefit greatly from it. And then the only other answer, of course, is we could see a lot more build out of internet to make it the point which having to conserve bandwidth isn't even necessary. But that doesn't seem to be happening. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrentonville, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.